about a very central issue involving Mayavad philosophy and theology in general. There's volumes and volumes of literature written on the status of language about God or the problem of talking about God. And the problem always has to do with the question of how does our language apply to transcendence. And the notion is, in all these cases, that we're taking something that's developed in and suited for one region, and we're trying to apply it or extrapolate it to another region, which is wholly unlike or quite different from our own area of experience. So this is always a big, big, big problem. And always a lot of doubt about how you can legitimately say anything at all about God. Now, as you can see with Mayavad philosophy, negative theology, mysticism, this reaches its extreme position that you can't say anything at all. And there's all these stories about the Buddha, you know, who taught the complete truth simply by smiling and holding up one finger in silence and so on. This is a Zen story, you know. Somebody asked Buddha some question about the ultimate truth. He smiled and held up one finger, and then somebody says, "Why is he such a chatterbox?" And intuitively, people will feel this objection about Krishna consciousness, especially since, even in the West, where they're supposedly theistic, as we talked before, mostly their descriptions of God are very abstract. They're concatenations, stringing together of abstractions. He's good, true, just, loving, all these kind of words like this. And then you say, well, he's a person, yes, but he's not a person like we know. He doesn't have faults and limitations and so on. And then finally, after you think about it for a while, and you think about what God must be like, how he's unlimited, how he knows everything, how he lives in a timeless present, that the word person gradually gets evacuated of all meaning. And you see what could be the possible resemblance between whatever kind of a person God is and what you have walking down around here on two legs. And then you say, well, you know, something like a person, or maybe he's the cause of person, so we call him that. But really, we can't know what he is. That's what Thomas Aquinas says. We can only know what God is not, not what he is. This is what happens to people. So then we come to Krishna consciousness, and we say, you know, Chintamani Prakara Sadmasu Kalpaviksha Lakshavriteshu, with a vengeance. A human form, hands, legs. We know his complexion. Prabhupada says we know his name, we know his address. All this very concrete, particular detail. He wears yellow. He has a gem on his chest. Circle of white hair, you know. Peacock feather, all these things. And people, then you have to be symbolic. You can't really mean it when we use all this language. Well, what does it really mean, they want to know. So this is a position we have to defend. But it all starts with this notion about language, that language is embedded in our material world, that we use it when we traffic back and forth with the things of this world. One philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, he said that language is like a toolbox full of tools, and it's meant to do certain things. you know, like monkey wrenches. He started out as an engineer, you know. Like monkey wrenches and Allen wrenches and pliers, and they do things, you know. And now you want to take this set of tools that's made for doing this, and now you want to take it to this whole new region, transcendence. Your tools are useless. You know, to use a different example, you're like somebody with a metric set of tools that comes a long distance to repair something and find out you need, you know, what's the other system than metric, huh?
Imperial.
Imperial system, right. So your tools are useless. And it's even more drastic like that. So what we have to say is that this presupposition we deny, that language originates here in this world, and that it emerges out of and is designed for our traffic with sense objects for sense gratification. We deny that premise. Where does language originate with? Where does everything originate with? It originates with Krishna. That's where it comes from. So that puts a whole new complexion on things right away. We say language comes from Krishna. Everything comes from Krishna. And so we say that, yes, it's true, that's a fact, that if you just take the language of this material world and by your speculative effort, you try to reach transcendence, you're not going to reach it, you know. They say you stretch it and stretch it and stretch it, it's like a rubber band, you know, and then finally it snaps. You know, you can't find anything out. No, we don't do like that. We say it comes from God. So if we have this language that talks about Krishna's names, his characteristics, his activities, his relationships, we say that language does not originate in this material world. Of course, their assumption is it all does. If they have that assumption, it's all myth. It's all made up. All these are stories. That's another thing. But we reject that. We say, no, this language comes from transcendence. And we say the Vedas are, what's the word in Sanskrit? Apurusheya. It's apurusheya. That's where that language comes from. And that language, this is the descending process. This is where you see right away when they describe this business of trying to take our language, which is embedded in this world, and stretching it to fit transcendence, they're describing the ascending process. But we're saying, no, that language comes from transcendence and comes down to earth. That's the descending process. And in fact, Prabhupada calls Srimad Bhagavatam book incarnation of Krishna. It descends. It's not a material product. So that's where language originates. And the original use of everything is in the service of Krishna. And therefore the original use of language is also to praise, glorify, and serve Krishna. That's what it's meant for. That's what our senses are for. When we speak of language, by the way, immediately we're talking about a sense, that is the tongue. So when we talk about speaking a language, we're talking immediately about engaging the senses. So the original use of language and the original use of the tongue, of speech, is to glorify Krishna. That's what it's meant for. And what has happened is that language has become perverted and distorted by our using it to traffic with objects of this material world for sense gratification.
So what is actually, the actual scene is, it is not that there's something that legitimately belongs here that we're illegitimately trying to take in transcendence. There's something that legitimately belongs in transcendence that really we're illegitimately using down here. So we just say no. We just turn the case around. So on that basis, we can defend Chintamani Prakara Sadhanasu Kalpa Viksha Laksha Vriteshu and so on. So this language that's used to glorify Krishna, this is the original language. Or even if we use our own mundane language, English, German, French, or whatever, they're all forms of degenerate Sanskrit, really. And we utilize it to glorify Krishna, then we're restoring that language to its original purpose and its original use. So this language that comes from transcendence is privileged language. And it's actually never mundane. Even though it's here, it's never mundane. And that's what Prabhupada says right away. I mean, all this is packed up. This whole, everything I'm explaining is really packed up when Prabhupada said Hare Krishna mantra springs. Is that what he says? He says springs from the, from the spiritual platform. It's all right there. It springs forth from the spiritual platform. And as there's variety of transcendence, there's language in transcendence, there's names in transcendence. So that always comes and is manifest here in this material world. So we say that this language tells us everything we need to know about Krishna. It's there. That's our justification for the use of this language. This is everybody who comes to this movement, everybody who, you know, they may believe in God and everything, but when they see the deities, when they see Krishna, it's so concrete and particular. And they've always so been trained to associate spirit with what is abstract, vague, amorphous, negative, not positive, that they can't imagine that this is the nature of spirit. So we have to be able to justify this lesson. And in that idea, that objection, there's a lot of Mayavad philosophy. So if you defeat that objection, actually, automatically, you defeat a lot of Mayavad philosophy, even though people may not realize that that's what's going on. So then the next question they say, when you explain this to them, and you tell them about Krishna, they say, oh, he said, but you can't really take that literally, playing on a flute, tending the cows, yielding all desires, head bedecked with peacock feather. You don't mean that literally, do you? Because that's what seems like the implication of what I've just said, that we take it literally. And as soon as you say literal, they think fundamentalist, you know. Literal has gotten a very, very bad name from, you know, the biblical literalists and things like that. You know, so they think that's what you mean. You're a fundamentalist, you know, stupid, uncritical, Bible belt kind of a guy. And we usually, we don't take it symbolically. We don't think it's metaphor. We don't think it's fictions. We believe everything it says. In Srimad Bhagavatam, nowhere did Prabhupada ever say you don't have to believe in these things, really. So does it mean we take it literally? Well, yeah, I think so. But we have to understand what we mean by literal. Because say we have a description of Krishna, let's say like in the hymns of the Brahma Samhita, you know, Venum kvanandam aravindam dalayataksha. There's Krishna. He plays on the flute, has a peacock feather in his head. Shaima sundaram achincha guna swarupam. So what does it mean? What do those words mean? And how do we know what they mean? Well, the literal meaning of these words, since they're transcendental words, since they come from the spiritual world, can only be understood by somebody who is spiritual. And this is the other verse. I didn't bring it with me. I'll tell you tomorrow where you can find it in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Atasi Krishna Namadi Nabhaved Grayam Indriyai. This is what Rupa Goswami says. It's from Nectar of Devotion. Prabhupada translates it in where the word for, he quotes it a lot, of course, but it's given a word-for-word translation in the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita. The names, forms, etc. of Krishna cannot be grasped by the materially contaminated senses. So that means that actually we cannot understand that language, the literal meaning of that language, if we have materially contaminated senses. Venum kunandam aravindam dalaya daksam. That means the literal meaning, what it actually means. Because this is the realm in which these words actually originate and actually apply. And if our senses are still all dirty because we are rooting around like pigs in a garbage heap looking for sense gratification here, then we can't understand, we can't grasp. So we have to be like a little agnostic in the sense that we have to say, well, I don't know. Well, depending on our advancement in Krishna consciousness, I may or may not know or grasp the literal meaning of these terms. But even if I don't understand this language, I can still use it because it's bona fide, it's valid, it's authorized. I didn't make it up. It's not my guess. I can still use it. And it's actually only by using it that my senses become purified so I can understand what I'm saying. Because that's the second half of Rupa Goswami's statement. Sevan mukehi jivado. But when the senses, beginning with the tongue, become purified by being engaged in Krishna service, then they can understand these things. So how can we purify the tongue unless we have some sounds for it to make? So these are the sounds that are given to us. And we use it. And then become purified, and gradually we grasp the original meaning, the literal meaning. But meanwhile, if we have our material ideas, then we have to say, no, our meaning so far is not literal. Because you take this word, you know, the word Krishna, actually, according to Sanskrit itself, one of the meanings of the word Krishna is given as black. It doesn't actually mean black. Kala is black. It means dark blue. Like dark blue. Or like the other word, Shyama. Krishna's name, Shyama Sundar, dark blue. Shyama is also dark blue. Dark blue and beautiful. So, well, we see dark blue around. We have examples, like a tamala tree. Like a brand new rain cloud with lightning inside. But these are all drawn from our sense experience in this world. So we use this word blue. You know, this is blue right here, right? So here I got this word blue. And you are applying it to God, but you're using the same word to apply to this color down here in the material world. This is an objection now to this thing. So this implies that there must be some connection or relationship between that blue and this blue in order for you to use this word. What is that relationship? How do they relate to each other? And we say, yeah, there's a connection. And here's an interesting thing to note about this issue of language. Earlier, I guess last class, I was talking about various theological ideas about how God is related to the world. And what you discover is that in theologies which say you can't talk about God as far as language goes, when it comes to giving you a picture of the relationship between God and the world, they also show no connection or little connection. Just as we saw in Shankaracharya, what's the relationship between the world of our experience and the impersonal Brahman? Well, there isn't any. So therefore, there's no way you can take language across that gap. Or if you take the Semitic idea, then there's a God who's in relationship to creation as the creator, but because he creates it ex nihilo, and is something very much unlike himself, there's God up here and there's the creation down here, and there's, you know, a gap of some kind. And even we saw in people like Meister Eckhart, there's a God, you know, who's a personal God, and somehow beyond there's another God, and we can't figure out how he relates to the, you know, Godhead relates to God. Or again with Plotinus, you know, somehow or other, they've always got a gap in there somehow or other. But when we come to Krishna consciousness, we find out there is a relationship. And this is one of the arguments that Prabhupada uses all the time. He says that you can discover, you can find out about Krishna by studying ourselves, for example. That's an extraordinary statement. He said, because we are small samples of God. And then he also said in a lecture, he said, we see here in this world that a boy has an attraction to a girl and girl has an attraction to a boy. He says, where does that come from? Janmadasya yataha. Everything comes from Krishna, so it is there in the absolute truth. That's the implication of janmadasya yataha. We see it is here, a boy has an attraction to girl, girl has an attraction to boy. So therefore we can understand it is there in the absolute truth. Janmadasyata, everything comes from there. And here he's invoking that principle I mentioned earlier, that you cannot give what you haven't got. If it's here, it's there. He also mentioned in another lecture that we see people like to play on musical instruments. He says that comes from Krishna. Same principle, janmadasyataha. He said that we see, we have senses, arms and legs, and therefore we can understand that Krishna has arms and legs. Because we are made in the image of God. This is in the beginning of the prayers to the personified Vedas, he gives this argument. We are made in the image of God. And he said, just like you can discover, you can find out what the Father is like by looking at the Son. It's So as above, so here below. So there is a resemblance because everything emanates from Krishna. Whatever is there is in Krishna is reflected in his creation. So there is some kind of resemblance. There is all right. This word blue, there is a connection. Because we don't have these gaps like the Semitic religions where you can't, there's a God up there, but you can't get from here to there, or even bigger gap, as you see in the Mayavada philosophy. So everything is related to Krishna. That's why this language, there's enough of a relationship that somehow or other, this language, which is originally meant to glorify Krishna, can be used here. Of course, we have to concoct things too. We have to make up new words, you know, microchip, things like that. But still, it's originally for Krishna. So in this way, this is the argument then about language. And as far as I can see, anyway, you'll find it on page 9 of this essay about religions of others in ISKCON's eyes. You'll find I have that argument given here. I put it down in front of a bunch of theologians and stuff. And I've never seen this argument used anywhere, by the way. Not in any modern literature. Not in any Christian literature. That I know of. Not in Thomas Old stuff. So, as far as I can see, it's our contribution. And it's our justification for... We can use this language about Krishna in full, 100% confidence. And if we don't know what it means now, we'll come to know what it means. As our senses become pure, we'll be able to understand. The materially contaminated mind and senses, we can't grasp. What happens in the process of becoming purified is the first stage when the language, it applies to the holy name of the Lord, but then by extension we can apply to everything else. Because really, when this language about Krishna finally becomes revealed to us, what we actually discover is the language and the object it describes are wholly identical. That's what makes it quite different from ordinary language. In this material world, the sound blue and blue things are going to be different. But in the spiritual world, when we say, you know, Shyama, Krishna is present. Krishna is directly in that name. So, this is revealed in that stage of chanting that's called bhava. You know, we have that progression beginning with shraddha of the development of Krishna consciousness. It's called a krama, a sequence, the chronological order. Ado shraddha, sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya. Do we all know this sequence? Anartha nivritti. And then bhava, at the bhava stage, which is the stage of ecstasy, at that point, there's the realization of Krishna and Krishna's name as identical. That's why symptoms of ecstasy start to appear on the body and so on, because of this direct perception of Krishna. But that comes when the chanting becomes free from offenses. And Prabhupada says the similar thing about Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a wonderful purport where the qualification of Sutta Goswami, it's in the second canto, no, first canto, is mentioned. That he heard Srimad Bhagavatam from Shukadeva Goswami with rapt attention. You know this purport, Rohini? You heard it with rapt attention. Prabhupada says he drank the nectar of Bhagavatam with his ears. And Prabhupada says, no one can hear with rapt attention who is not pure in mind. And no one can be pure in mind without being pure in eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. That is to say, in all the activities of life. When all the activities of life are purified, then the mind becomes pure. When the mind is pure, then one can hear Srimad Bhagavatam properly in rapt attention. When one hears with rapt attention, Prabhupada says, then Krishna appears directly in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. He says directly. That reading Srimad Bhagavatam, one actually witnesses the pastimes of Krishna. If I read a book, say, I can sit down and read a travel book, and somebody can be describing some far-off exotic place, like New York City. And if the author's very vivid, you know, I may get the sense of what it's like to walk down the, you know, artificial canyons of Wall Street, or go through the war-torn devastations of the Bronx and all these things. You know what I mean? If he's vivid, he can make me feel like I'm there. But imagine picking up a book about New York, and as soon as I start reading, I'm there. There's Wall Street, you know. There's the Bronx. There's Times Square. You know, and I'm right there. You don't have books like that. That's because this is the material world, and the name and the thing are different. But when it comes to Krishna, that book, Krishna is actually present. Why can't we perceive? Because the mind is impure, and the senses are impure. So there's no hassle about the meaning of language and about the big question they work out in the material world. What is the relationship between a name and the thing it names? Is it an artificial construction? Is it essential? You know, there's nominalists, there's realists, you know. How do words work? No, because it's identical. It's identical in Krishna's present, in his name, directly. Therefore, it's complete, direct revelation. It's Vaidusha Pratyaksha, direct perception. So when we chant the holy name, also we go through these stages. You know, the real holy name is up here, which is experienced in pure chanting. We don't experience that now because of our offenses against the holy name. But if we're trying to clear up the offenses, and therefore we're making progress, then we can experience not the holy name itself, but the effulgence of the holy name, the Nam Abbas, the twilight effulgence of the holy name, like the dawning twilight. Before the sun is up over the horizon, the light appears in the sky. So at the stage of Nam of clearing this halo or penumbra, aurora of the holy name is there. And then the holy name finally arises. And Thakur Haridas says, that penumbra, that aurora of the holy name is itself enough to bring liberation. It destroys all sinful reactions. Just as he says, before the sun is up, still, and the dawning twilight is in the sky, still, that makes the forest safe. All the thieves and hobgoblins and ghosts, they all retire. You know, Dracula has to go back into his coffin, become safe. So in the same way, all sinful reactions are obliterated by this. So in this way, there's a way that we can tell people, there's a rational process for understanding this language about Krishna. This rational process is, number one, Shraddha. Number two, Sadasanga. Number three, Bhajana Kriya. So many people have gone through this, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. They know the steps on the way. They know the transitions from one to another. They know the dangers and pitfalls. We are at various places along this path ourselves. We know we're progressing, even if some of us haven't attained the goal. And then you understand this language. There's no question of being agnostic. If you're agnostic or dubious, well, you just have to try the course. As Aldous Huxley says, knowledge depends upon being. Right? You have to get yourself into the right state. You have to make yourself the subject of a moral and psychological experiment. Takes too long? Well, if you want to do the experiment yourself, say to find out about whether electrons or protons really exist, you have to get a PhD in physics. Let's see, 4 years of undergraduate school, at least 4 more years coursework, 3 years to write a PhD, 8. Now, I think we can, you know, that's good. Takes a while too, doesn't it? Anyway, that's our doctrine about language. Why we can use this language about Krishna, why we can do it wholeheartedly. We don't have to have any doubts that maybe it doesn't apply, maybe it's symbolic, maybe we really don't mean it. No, we mean it. We really mean it. And the more we advance, the more we mean it. Yeah.
So Krishna's name, that could never be until it can tell you. But then other descriptions in the English language of Krishna's attributes, characteristics, those seem to they can be material.
No, I don't think so.
Well, yeah, I mean, use the word in a real Sanskrit way, it'd be hard to use Krishna's name in Sanskrit.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, they do that too. And sometimes Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I think, said it's not the name Krishna, it's just letters of the alphabet. Just remember when Ramachandra, when Ravana stole Sita, he got Maya Sita. He got a kind of fake duplicate made out of the material energy. So sometimes it's just not there.
It's like when the Maya body seems
very efficient. Yeah. It can be just not there at all. Name is not that. Rohini, you had your hand up, I'm sorry.
Thing is, what you say sounds okay, but there's a problem, at least from my perspective. I pride myself on being an objective, thinker. And if I undergo your process, then I'm going to have to lose my objectivity. Because I have to say, you said the first thing is faith. I'm going to have faith before I can begin anything else. So how can that be resolved?
Did you go to college?
No.
Did you go to grade school?
Yes.
It's not that if you want to engage any point of, if you want to engage in any process of knowledge, like in a university, say, or in a grade school, it starts with faith. In the matter of grade school, it may not be your faith. It may be your mom's faith. But it starts with faith. Faith that here's a teacher who can give me something I want to know. If you go to your beginning chemistry course, say at the university, the guy is going to teach you, I remember sitting there and they start talking right away about electron shells and covalent bonds and all this other stuff. And it's obviously gibberish. It's obviously it's a fact, that radically empirical philosophers, I mean philosophers who are really, really strict empiricists, refer to things like atoms and protons as metaphysical entities. You don't see them. They're really theoretical constructs. All you ever sometimes see are little phosphorescent dots on a screen, which through some process is supposed to represent something happened down there on a level that's inaccessible to our senses. So anyway, they're telling you about all of these far out esoteric things. And you sit there and you listen to it. And you open your notebook Everybody, hundreds of students are opening a notebook and they're accepting. They don't know anything. Why do they accept it? On faith. On faith. Wait, let me finish. On faith that this is Cambridge and that's an authorized university and this is Professor so-and-so and he has his doctorate degree and he's certified and this is where you go to get knowledge. So you begin with faith. And then as you develop later on, you become a graduate student in physics. Finally, they'll let you into the laboratory and let you use that expensive equipment. And you have the theoretical knowledge and the abilities. You can perform the experiments yourself and confirm everything yourself. That's what they say about science, right? Science is not faith, it's knowledge, and it's democratic. Right? Because anybody can come and follow this rational procedure and perform the experience themselves. Well, not everybody can get a PhD in physics, right? Most of us don't want to. But they say in principle, then they say, well, in principle, anyone can do it. That's their claim. But you have to go through a big process, then you can confirm. And it begins with faith. Well, I say all processes of knowledge begin in faith. And this is a process of knowledge. And like any other, it begins in faith. And in principle, anyone can do it and confirm by their own direct experience. So.
At least they don't make me, begin my day. I mean, I don't get enough time to even think myself anymore because your process is so...
Wait a minute. You go and see any PhD in physics, graduate student, or a medical student, or a law student. See how they begin their day. These guys are fanatics. Anybody who accomplishes anything worthwhile concentrates their energy, eliminates extraneous things from their lives, and dedicates their effort with a single-minded purpose. Oh, by the way, at the San Diego conference we had on deprogramming, there was a fellow there, I can't remember his name right now, it escapes me, who did a doctoral dissertation on giving tests to devotees, psychological tests to devotees. And he found out that devotees were normal in pretty much all respects, except for a high degree of obsessive compulsiveness. Well, this looks pretty bad, but what it means is you're the kind of person that, puts your mind to a goal and gets rid of everything else. This came up at this conference, and then there was a big discussion how anybody who wants to become a doctor, a lawyer, a PhD, has to be obsessive compulsive. And if you take any of these high achievement fields and look at the people, you'll find all of them are obsessive compulsive people. So that's just the price you pay for knowledge, for success. Silence. Okay, someone else has a question.
My colleagues here.
Anirudha, do you have something to say?
No, I just
have to
say.
Yeah.
You were saying that the contemporary languages are kind of a degenerate Sanskrit.
Yeah.
There's a function then of
there are also mentions of, Prabhupada says some places that all languages come from Sanskrit. I think the real claim is that all the Indo-European languages come from Sanskrit, because you see in Krishna book it's mentioned they're aboriginal languages. So some languages are aboriginal, but so I don't know exactly where they come from. But Sanskrit, the script is called Devanagari. It comes from the city of God. It's spoken. The language in the spiritual sky is apparently Sanskrit. I guess some places they speak Hebrew, but... anyway.
These offshoots of languages, they come about through Sanskrit adaptation.
Yeah, sure. We misuse that language, and as we purify our senses by using everything in Krishna's service, language also becomes purified. It'll be interesting to see what happens to language if Krishna consciousness actually takes hold, what kind of transformations language will go through. Right now, language is changing from the bottom up. new words, at least English, new words enter into the language. The first place you discover them is among junkies. And prison inmates. Then it moves to jazz musicians. Right? Huh? You know, I mean, the language changes always from the bottom up. It's always been the history of when language changes, the upper classes are very conservative and want to keep the old language. But it's the lower class people, you know, that they say ain't and don't and get their tenses mixed up and everything else. And, you know, this is what happens, you know. But it's a losing battle, huh?
What about accessing the interface and all these?
Oh, we got another place, yeah, from technology, and another low class. Prabhupada said that scientists are shudras because they spend all their time, you know, just building things. Yes, Manjari? Prabhupada applies this principle to Krishna to understand him. Now, this is the old, you know, this is another form of, I think, the old. This shows up in theological. If God is all great, can he make a rock so heavy he can't lift it? You know. Then he's not all powerful. You trap him in a paradox, you know. Either way, he's not all powerful. Now, I don't know what Prabhupada said about this. I think somebody reported he said, yeah, he makes the rock so heavy he can't lift it, then he lifts it. Well, that could be true because Krishna's always increasing, so that solves that one. But the old medieval answer to this was that to say something like this is just to talk gibberish. That was just to involve logic. It's involving things that are logically impossible. Like, can God make a square circle? Well, there's no such thing as a square circle. It's gibberish. It's just a concat. You know, just putting words together. Something is logically impossible. Well, God doesn't have to do the logically impossible.
At least he could make me God.
The position is taken, right? That's another one. If he is all powerful, can he make me God? The position's taken. And Prabhupada says, quite frankly, he doesn't. He just gives you the illusion. Right? Now, anyway, what he could do is another thing. But he abides by the same principles, so he doesn't give what he hasn't got. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you see, what happens is what's in the spiritual world then becomes worked out here in another way. So that definitely, when Prabhupada says we can understand about God by studying ourselves, obviously there have to be certain changes because you can't import the perfections of the material world to the spiritual world. So he says, pure, uncontaminated, without veins, etc. You know, I once had a devotee argue at length that Krishna did have veins, but they were spiritual veins. But Prabhupada said that his body is not full of pipes and pumps and tubes. And that one sense can perform the function of all the other senses. So there's a loss there. You know, there's a deprivation of unity or coherence and something like that. And so some kind of machinery is created of the material body. So you could ask other things like, well, there must be evil in the spiritual world because it comes from here, because it's here. But that's also a deprivation or a loss. Yeah. When there's lack of Krishna consciousness here, it doesn't mean there's lack of Krishna consciousness there. Although I guess you could argue that there's a kind of transcendental ignorance, isn't there? Yoga Maya potency is there. And there's three modes of material nature here, and there's some Vitladini and Sadini potencies there. So there's some parallels, you know, like that. But so far as I understand, yeah, guts, pipes, pumps, tubes, that's Krishna's arrangement to reduplicate in matter some image of what's going on in the material, in the spiritual world. So there's certain principles that follows, but obviously there are special applications here. But, you know, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how he works it out. I think our arguments are to get people to accept the process. If they still refuse, then what can be done?
then we go on to some more favorable people. We don't waste our time, right? To get them to accept the process. But while we want to make them accept the process, they can at least, I can't accept this process because how can you say God is blue? Well, this is why we can say God is blue. We're just trying to clear the way for them to accept the process. Well, I can't accept, you know, because of the arguments Rohini was given, I can't accept the process. Well, no, this is no different from any other process of knowledge, really. It's just not, you're not used to looking for knowledge in this way, in this direction. You're used to knowledge of the material world. This is the spiritual reality. You have to make yourself fit. But anyway, what I've given you here, I just ran across it in the sixth canto, where Prabhupada says the very thing that the original use of language is to glorify the Lord. I mean, this is bona fide stuff about our philosophy of language. It's there. Did you ask me?
Prabhupada differentiate, like, I think he said there
was a... Well, I don't know. There's some jokes like that.
I thought he was...
I may have just been speaking an old joke.
Oh.
You use German when you speak to your horse, English when you... I forgot how it goes.
It's a practical thing.
Yeah, vacuousness of this message of Krishna's growth on her is that it's translated. Does she never quite...
No, if it's translated by a pure devotee, or translated, following those footsteps by people who are actually Krishna's devotee, Prabhupada says it's all there. I'm not exactly sure how. You know, there's that famous translator is a traitor. But, anyway. Rest Supreme? Yes, sir?
I don't remember which canto Srila Prabhupada is explaining that the object of worship coming from the transcendental world, in that case he spoke about deity worship specifically. The nature of the deity depends on the perception of the person.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who has a matter of consciousness, deity is stone. So my question is, we know Golokera Pranadana, Sangita. So the nature of Krishna's mercy is always transcendental. And if something is invested by Krishna Shakti, whether it's words or stone or prasadam or whatever, how can it be that according to a perception, it takes a different nature?
Well, it's either you see or you don't see. And that applied to Krishna himself, right? When Prabhupada said when Krishna was on this planet, many people couldn't recognize, they couldn't see that he's God. In spite of everything, they couldn't see it because their vision was material. So it's a question of, you know, there's a difference between cognition and recognition, or knowledge and acknowledgement. So we can see something, but we may not recognize it. There's cognition, but there's no recognition. Prabhupada gave the example. Somebody says, "Did you see the President of the United States? He's right here." "No, I didn't see him." Well, you saw him, but you didn't recognize.
Yeah, but that doesn't affect the nature of the object.
No, not at all. It's us. Well, there's variety in transcendental items, so I don't know exactly how they are alive or how they personally reciprocate. I think that's been said about prasadam, you know, that it's conscious and that so on. Prasadam, conscious. If it's Krishna, but it's Krishna in this particular form who's to be dealt with in this particular way. So we treat Krishna as prasadam in one way, we honor it in one way, we honor Krishna as the deity in another way, we honor Krishna as the holy name in another way. We just have to follow those instructions. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
We say he's blue. When Prabhupada was asked, you know, what does Krishna look like? He pointed a picture and said, just like that. Now, I don't know what the Prabhupada looking at that picture was seeing Krishna, or somebody else may have been seeing a Brijbasi poster of Krishna. That's a fact. But anyway, that was Prabhupada's response, just like that. When people said to him, well, have you seen God? And he say, yes. And he says, he's right there, and he pointed to the deity. And they're trying to say, well, I mean. But Prabhupada said, no, there he is. No? So what is, he's blue. What is that blue? Well, just like a new rain cloud, you know. That's what Krishna's blue is. We say he's blue. But you say, well, you mean this blue just like in the material world? Well, it's transcendental blue. It's the original blue. This blue is kind of a faint imitation. Well, how do I know what that blue looks like? I knew I was going to get into a blue, Arjuna, right? How do I know what that blue looks like? Well, how do you describe any color to a blind person? You have to say it's the real blue. You know, it's the original blue. It's so blue it makes your teeth ache. You know, you have to see it. You have to see it. And all I can do, you know, especially with blue, these are, you know, certain basic sense qualities can only be defined. The word is ostensibly. You can define something ostensibly. What is blue? How will I define blue for you? Well, even if I say a certain wavelength, that doesn't define it. The only way I can ever do is go say, this is blue, you know, his jacket's blue, his wall is blue. That's like when you define by pointing, that's ostensive definition.
What's the difference between that and ostensibly?
I don't know. Probably related. Anyway, this is called ostensive definition. So certain things you can only define that way. So we have to say, well, what is it like? What is transcendental blue?